Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today we are pleased and indeed honored to have with us Master Historian Professor Peter Heather. Professor Heather is Chairman of the Medieval History at King's College London. He is without a doubt one of the leading historians dealing with the ancient world, and today we are discussing his latest book, Why Empires Fall, Rome, America, and the Future of the West, co-authored with John Rapley, published by Alan Lane. Welcome, Professor Heather.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here, and I'm glad you find the book interesting enough to want to talk about it.
Professor, what is the thesis of the book?
Well, the underlying thesis, and it came out of a conversation I had with my co-author, who's a modernist, is that we both think that the way that long-lasting imperial systems, not things that only last for, 20, 30, 40 years, but imperial systems that last for centuries, the way that they operate tend to undermine the continued existence of that imperial system as an empire by sponsoring accidentally sponsoring economic, political, and development in the region around the empire, so that its original power and advantage is undermined. So in that sense, empires are unconsciously the architects of their own downfall, at least in the way in which originally created or came into existence.
Is the Gibbon-esque discourse about the decline of the West new, or decline of empire, I should say, and concomitant decline of the West when employed by contemporaries, new? Isn't something that has been on the radar screen in terms of discourse since at least Spengler's Decline of the West, if not earlier?
Oh, certainly so. This is a well-established trope, I think, in modern, and it focuses kind of on morality and sort of willpower, that kind of area of human action, I suppose. One of our chief aims, and this is something that I share with my colleague within my room, to try and confront this discourse, but I think it's very substantially misplaced, and it's not understanding what's going on. And of course, if you don't understand what's going on, particularly to institute reactions that are not the most helpful that you can think of.
Why was Gibbon wrong about the causation of the decline of the Roman Empire?
Well, the fundamental fact that he's wrong about, and it's not his fault because it wasn't known, is the supposition that the empire, its economic apogee in the Antithetic Age in the second century. This was the great age of empire, and that it was all slowly but surely from that point onward. And that was a sort of general chronological framework which held good up until about 1980. The idea that actually the political end, the consequence of an economic decline. And it's there in all textbooks of the early and mid-century. What's proved it wrong, fundamentally, is the emergence of a whole new data which he didn't have access. I mean, Gibbon read absolutely everything that was available, and he read it very carefully. I remember seeing a footnote in Bury's Gibbon where he says, I don't know where Gibbon from. Actually, he had got that from Isidore Seville's History of the Goths. I happened to read it, and I knew exactly where the passage came from. Gibbon read everything, and you read. But of course, he didn't have access to the sort of modern the modern archaeological data set. And it was really the emergence of new techniques in the 1970s which allowed you, for the first time, to take a broad sample of the demographic and economic health of the countryside. So it changed everything. Because the Roman economy, you're looking to judge its health or otherwise. How is agriculture doing? What is the demographic state of the countryside? You know, Roman did it firmly rooted, in agriculture. And by the 1970s, you've got techniques that allow you to take a pretty good sample using densities of now dated pottery evidence. You can date Roman pottery because its sequence is very well known, very well established by the 1970s, to within a decade. And you can see how much pottery there is, and densities of pottery gives you a sense of numbers of settlements. And so you can actually take a sample of the density of rural populations for the first time from the 1970s onwards. And people start to employ these all over the Roman pottery. Other eras apart from the Roman at the same time. The archaeologists are getting very excited by this new technique, as rightly they should. But what emerged from this is that with a very few, the 4th century AD is a period in the political dismemberment is the moment of maximum activity in the rural economy. More people doing more. In other words, imperial GDP, right, if you take the empire as a whole, must be at a maximum in the 4th century of the entire, half a millennium. In other words, the Gibbonian peak prosperity in the 2nd century, followed by toil, but then empire, and then political dismemberment, it's just wrong. And, you know, this is the single most exciting fact you have emerged in 100 years, I think.
Is that the question of scale the reason why comparing the modern West with the Roman Empire a bit of a stretch?
There are lots of stretches. You know, in a sense, we're using the Roman Empire to think about the modern West a bit, rather than claiming that they are exactly parallel lives. That would not be a sensible thing to do, and it's not really what we're trying to do, I think. But I don't think that the question of scale is so far off. In fact, and that, I think that's an excellent question. I suspect you're loading it deliberately in my direction, because the thing about the Roman Empire is that you have to factor in the question of speed. So the Roman Empire runs from Hadrian's Wall to Iraq on its longest diagonal. And that, even in modern terms, you know, that's quite a lengthy journey. But, of course, the real measure of distance was late in the ancient world. Well, the sort of average maximum speed that you could manage would be something like 25 miles a day. Or 40 kilometers a day. So in terms of actual distance as measured in terms of human journeying, then the Roman Empire is much bigger than it looks. And in fact, I've done, for the purposes of teaching, I've done some rough estimates It takes several months of average speed land journeying to get from one end of the Roman Empire to another. It's actually bigger than the modern Western Empire, I think, in reality, in the sense that it would take you longer to get from one end to the other, even if you left outside airplanes. So it is as big within its own context, I think, as the modern West is. But I absolutely take your point. There are some very substantial differences between the two that really do need to be factored in. You can't just say one is the equivalent of the other.
In your discussion of the post-Roman West after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, you did not discuss or seem to minimalize, and correct me if I'm wrong that in this instance, the aspect of widespread economic decline, a.k.a. the Ward-Perkins thesis.
Yes, we're much more focused on the process of unraveling in why empires fall than necessarily in outcomes. Certainly. I mean, I think this is the other side of the coin, the same coin of late Roman prosperity, is that it becomes clear that in large parts of the former Roman West, after the empire disappears, you get a substantial demographic and economic decline. How big that is a little bit difficult to measure in terms of, you know, fall off of population and so on, because the datable late Roman pottery gives you a proxy measure of the size of population in the late Roman period. And it's, you know, you can tell things like the size of the population of late Roman Britain in the 4th century is as big as the population of Britain will be, or it will only get that big again just on the eve of the Black Death, around about 1300, after a great deal of economic expansion after the Norman Conquest in the 12th to 13th century. So you can do sort of rough magnitude scale like that from the pottery evidence. But the pottery evidence from the post-Roman period is much less well known and much less easy to identify. What is very clear is that over most of the post-Roman West, there is a great deal of economic simplification in terms of much less exchange and trade. That is crystal clear, and no one doubts that. I think no one doubts that there's some substantial economic and demographic decline to very difficult to put a number on it.
In the book, you have a detailed and intricate discussion of the concepts of core, periphery, inner periphery, and outer periphery. Can you explicate a little bit of that for the audience?
Certainly. So a model that I had in my head, I've had in my head for 20 odd years, really. Actually, I'm misstating it. More like 30. Time flies when you're having fun. A way of trying to think about the patterns of development that are visible in the Roman period, and in fact across the first millennium AD more generally, when you look at the evidence of both text and archaeology, in fact. And that is, you have, when you've got these imperial systems operating, you have a core area of maximum development, which is usually defined by the formal imperial borders. Then you have an immediate inner peripheral area, which is in quite intense relationship with that empire. In the Roman case, and this is work done by other people that I was thinking about, you've got a zone up to about 100 kilometers wide along Rome's European frontiers, where in the sort of period, 300 years from around the birth of Christ down to the 4th century, you see very substantial changes in terms of greater numbers of settlements, more intensive agriculture, greater size of population more substantial political structures. That's where the texts come in. They show you that. And that inner zone is the zone that's in most intense relationship with the Roman imperial system, where the Romans are interfering all the time with policies that both reward friends, discourage enemies, manipulate political relationships, but offer economic incentives too. So you have that inner zone, but then you have an outer zone where you're not seeing everyday exchanges between the Roman imperial system and this zone beyond the kind of 100-kilometer fringe, but you are seeing substantial exchanges, the kind of exchanges that do have effects over the long term. And although that broader area, the outer periphery, is not neither so intensively changed or transformed by its relationship with the empire, nonetheless, you do see some substantial change within it. And although it's not in such close relationship with the empire, it is in some relationship with it. So I had this kind of tripartite model in my head for a long time. And it was basically, you know, the idea of center and periphery is very well established. But I felt that actually putting in the outer, making a distinction between inner periphery and outer periphery was very helpful because it captured both the difference in intensities of transformation that take place in those two zones. And it also kind of explains why, when you do see exciting disturbances to the broader system as a whole, they tend to come from the outer periphery rather than the inner periphery, because the inner periphery is more controlled and is in a more stable type of relationship with the Roman imperial system. Therefore, it's much harder for groups within the inner periphery to do anything really outside the box. I mean, they're not, relationships are never completely peaceful. There are always problems, but they're problems within a kind of defined set of parameters. I was talking about this with my colleague, John Rackley, and we were thinking about the way modern imperial systems have worked, the modern Western imperial system. We did feel that actually that tripartite vision of the overall system, of its core, of its inner periphery and its outer periphery, works well enough to be worth including, and worked in the same kind of way. So it's about how intensively the inner periphery versus the outer periphery is engaged in producing goods and supplying people or whatever goods and services for the imperial system, and then also the degree of transformation that that relationship works. But in the inner periphery, you get a much more substantial transformation as a result of the way the system is working, and a less substantial one in the outer periphery.
Speaking of the outer periphery, how did the Huns in the 4th and 5th century AD impact the Roman world?
In my view, what they do is create a kind of accidental unity amongst the client states of Rome's inner periphery. The kind of entities that had emerged in Rome's inner periphery by the 4th century, so things like the Gothic Tervindii in the, you know, close to the mouth of the Danube, or the Alemanni at the confluence between the Rhine and the Danube in West Central Europe, they could be a nuisance. They were big enough and stable enough that they couldn't easily be destroyed. They had a sort of long-term continuities. They were a regional pain in the rear end occasionally, but they were not big enough to challenge or threaten the Roman imperial system as a whole, nor did it even cross their minds that they might do so. But in my view, what the Huns do is push enough of these central, inner peripheral groups accidentally together and operating together to create a much more substantial threat to the continued operation of the imperial system. So that, for instance, the Visigothic and Ostrogothic confederations that eventually do create some of the successive states to the Western Roman Empire in Spain and some Gaul and Italy. They are new confederations built on Roman soil out of several different groups from the inner periphery, which had previously been politically separate from one another, but the effects of the various different effects of Hunnic intrusion make enough of these inner peripheral groups form together to put together a new confederation that's actually big enough to confront the Roman state more successfully. I mean, the basic test of all these things is, can they stand up in battle to a major Roman field army? They don't necessarily have to win, I think, but can they at least get a draw if they come into head-on conflict with a Roman imperial field armies? And whereas none of the inner peripheral client states of the 4th century by themselves could do it, when you put several of them together, the Visigoths, for instance, comprise contingents for about 3 or 4, then they can. And that's the game changer, I think.
Is it not questionable to characterize the Persian state of the 3rd and 4th and 5th century AD as, quote, a superpower competitor, unquote? Was it not, in fact, a mere regional power, unlike Rome?
Well, I certainly know that some of my colleagues who work on this do make the point that Rome's resources are much larger, the demographic resources and economic resources, and that's a perfectly fair point. On the other hand, what the revivified Sasanian Persian state, the 3rd century, can do, which no one else could do at the time, was actually, and this is before, you know, these new confederations form on the European theater, they can actually destroy Roman field armies. You have 3 major Roman field armies utterly destroyed by the Persians in the 3rd century. You can say in part that's because Rome couldn't concentrate all its forces in the east because that would be too much exposed on other frontiers. And in that sense, Rome is a bigger power than Persia is, and I would accept that point. But on the other hand, Persia is a superpower competitor because it can actually destroy the maximum size army that Rome can concentrate against it in the 3rd century, and nothing in the European theatre can do that at that time. So, yeah, this is perhaps slightly stretching it, but only very slightly stretching it. And I do think it certainly is the case that, you know, we don't really know what it was that the Sasanians did, but they did something new in terms of social, political, and military and economic mobilization in the Near East. That makes Persia a much more effective military power. The same raw materials have been around for hundreds of years, but they're organizing in a way that makes it much more effective. And they do destroy Roman armies, and large ones. And that reorganization, I think, certainly is a response to the intrusion of Roman power into their own zones in the previous decades.
Why, in your view, is the contemporary West in crisis?
To my mind, it's very straightforward, though not very straightforward to know what to do about it. And that is, if you're thinking about the generation of new wealth where production is sourced, then we've seen the movement of production away from most of the old centers in the West to new areas of the world. That has not led to any, or only to very limited, absolute declines of wealth in the West. In fact, for the most part, all we're seeing is a slowdown in the increase of wealth in the West. The West is not remotely getting poorer. It's actually that new centers are getting richer, the places where industrial production has moved to. So I think that's one very important constituent part, deindustrialization, if you like. The second part, I think, of the crisis is the internal political effects of the economic changes associated with deindustrialization, in the sense that they're very unevenly spread, because a lot of the development of the new productive capacity in non-Western parts of the planet, that is actually funded by capital, by Western capital, by pension funds, by whatever, investment portfolios of different kinds. And any Westerners who have pensions, who have enough money to be involved in the investment process, they're still making plenty of money because they're benefiting from the rise of the new industrial centers through the profits that those centers generate. The problem, I think, lies for the traditional Western working classes, who used to be tied into the actual production of wealth by having jobs in manufacturing sectors and whatever. And it's that traditional grouping that's kind of left high and dry by this. They don't have enough personal wealth, bluffing about, and to have either pension funds or personal investment portfolios that allow them to benefit from the new wealth being generated globally, and the kind of well-paid and very satisfying jobs in production that were directly tied into the generation of new wealth, those have disappeared. And so I think not only are you seeing a relative decline of overall Western wealth, which actually just may be a good thing for the planet, frankly, but you're seeing a large-scale internal division within Western societies, where one group continues to benefit from the new wealth being generated globally and another large group is not benefiting. And I do think that underlines the kind of broader social division that it's very evident in modern Western societies that take lots of different forms in different places. It was there in the Brexit debate. They're very much in the bodies of Trump supporters, for instance, I think, in the States. Also there in the sort of divide in France and Italy, which has seen very populist politicians gaining a great deal of popularity.
But would you say that these social and political divisions are something which are new of the last 20 years? I could be very well argue that these are intrinsic to democratic, these divisions, socioeconomic, are intrinsic to democratic capitalist society as a whole and have been present since the mid to late 19th century?
The sort of classic, the classic Marxist analysis obviously lines up capitalist against working class, and there is a strong element of division there. But the way these things worked out in practice, certainly in Britain and, you know, in America too, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, is that there was plenty of wealth to go around in terms of enough to satisfy expectations. So your traditional and classic working classes could expect and did in fact see standards of living increase generation upon generation. Each generation was substantially and clearly better off than preceding generations, and that didn't mean that there wasn't discontent, but didn't mean that everyone was happy. There are lots of reasons in life for people not to be completely happy, of course, but there was a kind of basic acceptance of the order, that the order was dishing out things to most people. But that, I think that expectation is what the disappearance of industrial production, or large-scale industrial production in the West, has undermined. It isn't the case anymore that succeeding generations can guarantee to be more prosperous than their parents and grandparents. Indeed, certainly in large parts of the West, that isn't true anymore. I think while divides have always been there, we're seeing a new divide, which is perhaps a little bit more problematic, in terms of it's not clear what to do about it. So, you know, in the old days, divides could be dealt with via pay rises, by improvement conditions, healthcare benefits, you know, the whole range of things you can do, which ameliorate it, the divide. I mean, that, and it's the, if I think about Britain, that's the sort of history of Britain in the 19th through to the sort of 1960s, 1970s, that is what Britain is about. There are social divides there, but there's enough leverage for organized, large-scale working class groups to extract better standard of living over time. But if you cut large parts of your population off from participation in the basic generation of wealth, consigning them to service industries or to social benefits of one kind or another, then you're creating that's a different level of divide and a different level of problem, I think.
Yes, but would you compare contemporary problems in terms of social divisions similar to what you had? I think you're old enough to remember what occurred in the mid-70s, where you had industrial action, which had the effect of there being electronic electric outages for 3 to 5 days a week.
Yes, the great power cuts of the 1970s, yes, I remember them very well. That was already, I think, symptomatic of the first shift, because you know what the problem there in the 1970s is, where Britain might be heading currently, namely stagflation, where prices are going up, but actual real wealth is not, and that was in response to the first oil price hikes of the 1970s that kind of really entrenched stagflation as a phenomenon in the West. And that, of course, was the first stirrings of the non-Western periphery realizing what muscle it had, the oil producers suddenly realizing that actually, sorry, I was about to say they had the worst ever barrel. It was a very undeliberate, unconscious pun. I do apologize even for thinking it. But you know, that was the start of the process. So in a sense, I think it is the same process that we deferred via the sort of globalization. We deferred the effects of the rise of peripheral power for a bit in the West. But and that's something that John and I argue in the book. But but this is a process that has been unfolding for half a century, I think, more or less.
You go to great lengths in the book to show that third world migration into the West is more or less, quote, a good thing, unquote. But in view of the fact that artificial intelligence is supposed to make X percentage of the existing workforce in the West redundant, is that... does that still make sense to have large-scale third-world immigration to the West?
I think we will need it. I mean, AI generates a huge question for all of us. Because, you know, if you make whatever percentage of the workforce redundant, then what are they meant to do? And what is their standard of living to be? And are society is really going to be willing to share wealth equally amongst those who do things and those who don't do things? I mean, I don't know the answer to these, pretend to, but that's a serious issue. There's also, there's a lot of hype around AI at the moment, which is impossible to be sure where the end result is going to be. All one can say is, current circumstances, Western societies are faced with democratic patterns. It is only Israel and Iceland where, amongst Western societies, the population is replacing itself in each generation. Everywhere else, you've got birth rates are so low, which means, and you've also got healthcare improvements, which I say are substantial, which means that you've got less and less people working to support more and more people who are retired, and that is not sustainable. One obvious response to that is to make up the shortfalls in your labor force from migration, which is what a lot of countries in reality are doing, whatever they say in their political discourses. And what is extremely clear is that the kind of migration that's really challenged and undermined the old Western domination of wealth production is not migration into the West, but the migration into the new industrial centers of the third world. So it's missing the point. And the economic data is very clear. Migrants into Western countries punch above their weight. They produce more than they consume, and they're straightforwardly an economic benefit. That doesn't mean that there aren't issues, so I wouldn't pretend that for a moment. The real world is a difficult place. There are issues of cultural integration. The influx of immigrants can undermine wages in certain sectors. That is true, but the overall effect is actually beneficial. And the big problem is the demographic transition in the West, because we do not have, do we really want our grandparents to be looked after by machines? They tried that in Japan and they give it up. And actually the first kind of breach in Japan's very fierce anti-immigrant regime has been precisely to provide people to work in the healthcare sectors, looking after the elderly. So, there's a real big issue there. And I'm not saying I know what the answer is, but I certainly, whenever I see a kind of migration debate in the UK, which does not talk about the demographic transition happening currently, and only halfway through in the modern Western world, where everyone is living longer, but we're absolutely insisting on maintaining the same retirement regime, if that is not included in the discussion of migration, then you've got a discourse that is insufficient, that is not seeing the problem in the round, and thinking about the problem in the round, I think.
Why do you believe that what they characterize as appeasement of China is a good strategy for the West to follow?
I don't actually think that we quite advocate appeasement. I think we advocate strong, careful dialogue. And what we don't, obviously, and what we strongly argue against is a kind of sort of blanket confrontation of China. And there are several reasons for that. The first is, of course, that we're on the other side of globalization already, and Western and Chinese economies are already deeply interlinked. And in fact, when Trump instilled his economic war with China, the effects were much worse in America than they were in China, because America lost markets and didn't affect Chinese production, and Chinese sold elsewhere. The second reason would be that Chinese assistance is required for the really serious problems. I mean, to my mind, the really serious problems are pollution and climate and environment. And, there's no one country that's big enough to have much of an effect on these kinds of problems. If it doesn't act in consolidation with everyone else, I mean, nearly everyone's got to act together to have any kind of useful effect. And these, to my mind, are the big issues of the day. The third reason is that China is not attempting large-scale directly expansionist policies towards its neighbors. It's kind of, flexing its biceps in the China Sea a bit. It's making noises about Taiwan, but it's not actually, and haven't done yet, and I suspect it won't, engage in expansionist military adventurism of the kind that Putin is engaged in, for instance. And certainly to assume that it would is a rash thing to do. So I think, and then there's a fourth reason, which isn't really that China is yesterday's problem. Chinese, the fundamental linkage that we're always working with in the book is that political and military power is closely linked to economic power. Economic power plus one generation is when you see, for its implications to work itself out, that's when you see political and military power. Well, you know, the Chinese economy is already slowing, and it's slowing for all kinds of reasons. It's picked a lot of hanging fruit. Its population is declining because of the previous demographic policies that's been enacted, and the new engines of growth in the global economy are not in China at all. He may be out by one. It might be 6 out of 10, Rodney, but I think it's 7 out of 10 of the world's currently fastest growing economies are in Africa. They're not in China. Yeah, this is a much broader transition than China. China is not the epicenter of what's going on. You've got to understand that it's a much bigger phenomenon, and it's not over yet. And so to kind of demonize China and to focus too much on China, rather than seeing China in the context of this broader global transformation, that's incorrect. And it's also, I think, very unhelpfully unrealistic in the sense that Chinese help is going to be absolutely crucial in resolving the problems that we all face.
Why do you say, quote, the West cannot make itself great again in old terms, unquote?
It comes back to this very simple underlying point that power is related to military. Political power is clearly linked to economic power. There's that old classic, the classic All the President's Men Watergate investigation, where they have the watchword, follow the money. And that's our watchword too, and it should be everyone's watchword. See where wealth is collecting, that's where the centers of economic, that's where the centers of political and military power will be, or strategic, if you like, strategic power. You know, when the British Empire was the economically dominant unit in the globe in the 19th century, then Britain was the dominant global power. When America transcended it in the 20th century, America became the dominant global power. The West was reached its apogee of sort of collective world dominance in the year 2000, at which point 80% of global GDP was concentrated in the West. I mean, that's astonishing. 4/5 of the wealth of the world consumed and generated in the West. But, you know, that's gone down to 60% immediately after the crash of 2008, and it is slowly but surely declining, carrying on declining now. And not because the West is getting poorer, but because other parts of the world are getting richer. So you cannot recreate a level of Western dominance that was predicated on a colossal 80% of global GDP when the Western share of GDP is declining under 60, and will presumably, there's every reason to suppose it will continue to decline subsequently. So you can't do it in the same way. The sort of tectonic plates of the world economy have shifted, and you can't shift them back again, and not easily, or I think at all. I mean, not in anything that we can envisage. So the collective West has got to get used to the fact that while still very wealthy and while still very important, and it's likely to remain so for the foreseeable future in global terms, it does not exercise the same kind of global reach that it did particularly in the 50 years after the end of World War II, you might say. Well, that's the kind of era of massive economic and therefore political and military domination.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, Professor, what would it be?
I think it's that, really. The reception of the book has been quite interesting to me, and I guess I've been slightly naive. I mean, what interested me is the model of the way empires work to undermine their own existence by developing the periphery. And in intellectual terms, as a historian, that's the thing that so interested me. and finding that one can, with a degree of reasonable plausibility, argue that the same thing is going on in the modern world as went on in first millennium AD Europe is just intellectually exciting. But I realized what people are interested in, of course, is the future of the world for them and for their children and for their grandchildren. So they're more interested in the kind of, you know, consequences of this beautiful abstract intellectual model, which is what mostly interested me in generating the book. And I think if you were asking me to think about that dimension of things, then the acceptance of the fact that Western economic dominance can never be again what it was in the 19th and 20th centuries, culminating in around the year 2000 with this colossal 80% of world global GDP figure, that it can never be like that again. That doesn't mean that everyone's getting poorer. In fact, the Western economy, even the economy of post-Brexit Britain, still continues to limp into growth figures, positive growth figures. We're not all getting poorer, but the rest of the world is getting richer, and the world has changed around us, and we need to accept that, not try to restore impossible old models, but to think about how to make the best of the new conditions, because you can't turn the clock back. These structures have moved. We played a major role in moving them ourselves by supplying all the capital that has developed production elsewhere on the planet. So be it. So let's think more positively about where we go from here.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Heather, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Heather, very much.
Thank you so much for having me.